And there's a reason we only had four songs. You may have guessed what it is. There's a reason I asked Craig how long those CDs would record. We're in Romans chapter 13. If you remember, a month or so ago, I looked at these seven verses, or we read the seven verses, and I kind of gave us a preface of talking about the seven verses by talking about something that is in us that causes us to have a reaction, an inner reaction to this word submission, to the idea of having to submit to authority of any kind. And I gave you five or six things that I want to just go through them briefly. But first, let's read our text. Don't you have our text in mind when we talk about those? Are y'all warm or is it just me?
Warm.
All right.
Oh, just
nobody asked you, Carol. Somebody might want to turn that heat off or something. Carol's the only one. Me and Vicky are warm, aren't we, Vicky?
Yeah, you guys are just, I won't say.
Romans chapter 13. Let's read our text, first seven verses. Where Paul says, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Will thou be then afraid of the power? Do what is good, and you will have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do what is evil, be afraid, for he bears not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him who does evil. Wherefore you must need be subject not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause pay your tributes also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their due, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor." Now, a month ago, I talked about five or six things, and here they are, if you see on your outline. The first was this, is that somebody is going to be in charge. And we talked about it, doesn't matter if it's on the playground, if it's on the ball court, if it's in a marriage, wherever it is, somebody is going to end up leading the group. Doesn't matter where it's at. That is just a fact of life. The second thing is that somebody needs to be in charge. We are such that we need somebody to lead the way in whatever endeavor it is so that things may progress in an efficient manner. It doesn't matter. On a playground, it's not that crucial, but on a job site, it is. Or in a home, in a family, it is. Or in a church, or a state government, it is. Somebody needs to be leading. The third thing we talked about is someone needs to be leading, not 50 Indians or 50 chiefs and no Indians. Some one person needs to be in charge. And that doesn't necessarily have to be one, but it has to be one united voice. And again, on the playground, that doesn't matter. But in a home, it does. In a home, it does. The kids don't need to see a different set of instructions from mom and another one from dad. Some one person needs to be leading, a united voice. The next one is this, that why can't that someone be me? Why do I have to be the one who takes orders? Why can't I always be the one who gives them? And that speaks of something inside us that resists authority. It's in all of us. Some people, it comes out more than others. But in us, we don't mind doing what somebody says as long as that's what we wanted to do to start with. But tell us something that we really don't want to do or we really don't agree with, and you'll see us buck. And then the last thing, someone, whoever the someone is who's in charge, will often abuse their power. You see that over and over and over again. That's one way we justify our resistance to authority is because it's been abused. And sometimes, obviously, our resistance might be justified. But here this all this stuff is in our hearts. It's in us. And when we approach texts like this right here, we approach them with a little bit of the hackles starting to come up on the back of our neck. So keep those things in mind as we look at our text. Now, you see on the outline, point number one, guiding principles. I want to tell you, ever how many A through H is, six or seven things here, that this text says. All right, so let's see what they are. A, all citizens of a nation or society are morally obligated to submit themselves to the governing authorities of their nation or society. Okay, let's look at some key words there. All citizens of a nation or society are morally obligated. Why are we morally obligated to submit ourselves to the governing body of our society? Because this verse tells us to. It obligates us morally to do it. So what about if a country, we live in a country, our country is fairly stable compared to a lot of the world. But what if in some places in the world there is a country who is governed by a tyrant today, and you're just a common person in the country there, and you have been submitting yourself to their authority for whatever reason, you're under their authority, and then next week there's a big overthrow of the government and there's a new one, a new leader. Are you obligated to submit to that new authority? This text doesn't give us exceptions like that, does it? It says, whatever the government authority is, submit to it. That's the first principle that's found in these verses. B, all governing authorities, both bad, good and bad, are allowed to, or, I will say this in a different way, ordained to rule by God because of His sovereign rule over His creation. It doesn't matter what. This text doesn't give exceptions, doesn't give specific things, just says submit yourself to the government. It doesn't matter if the government is good or bad. It doesn't matter anything about it. These verses say that God ordained it. God set it in place. Now you can look at that in a passive way. And I've got both of those kind of listed. God allowed it to take place. It kind of gives you a little better feeling about it. Or you can say what the text says, God ordained it. God intentionally decreed it that this evil government is in place. Are we to submit to that kind of authority? He doesn't tell us not to. He doesn't make that kind of exception. The text gives us an absolute statement. Submit to authorities because God has ordained them, even the tyrants, even the evil ones. God ordained their leadership in that role, in that country. C, when we resist our authorities, we resist God's appointment and invite judgment upon ourselves from both God and the authorities that we resist. Now this one, C, is sort of a conclusion from A and B. If A and B are true, if God says A and B, then C follows. If we're to submit to any government, every government that we are living under, we don't have to submit to other countries' government if we're in the United States. When we go to their country, we do. But we're to submit to every government. We have this thought and this idea and this truth, this fact, that God has ordained these governments. It follows then that when we resist, or if we resist that government, we resist not just the government, but we resist God's appointment as well. And we are in danger of inviting upon ourselves wrath, both from God and from the local government whom we resist. D. If we do good in the sight of our authorities, we have no cause to fear. They will praise those who do good, and they will punish those who do evil. Now, let's think about something just for a second. This says, if we do good, you notice I got that in quotes, in the sight of the leaders, in sight of the government. Now that raises a question to me, at least. There may be a difference between what's good in the sight of the government and what's good in the sight of God. So, does that leave me a way out? I don't think so. At least not yet. Because the implications in these verses are that God, this government here is a minister for God. And as a general rule, it doesn't matter how evil the government is, if somebody is disruptive, that government usually will stop them because they need to keep the people at peace. They need to keep the people corralled. If you go on a killing spree in whatever country it is, the government will stop you. If you go on a looting and rioting raid in whatever country it is in the world, somebody will call your hand. Unless you're in Ferguson, Missouri, right? But as in a general way, governments punish evil. They punish wrongdoing. And that's what these verses say. Number E, when measuring out this praise or when measuring out this wrath, the governments are acting in God's stead. They are God's spokesman, Paul says in these verses. Then number F. There are two reasons then, and this is sort of what follows as well, a conclusion from what follows. There are two reasons then that you should submit to authority. There are two reasons that I should submit to authority. One is because I fear their wrath. There are several reasons I don't go rob the bank. One of them is I don't want to go to jail. One of them is I don't think I can get away with it. I don't think I can, I think the law will catch me. There's fear of authority. That's one reason to submit to authority. The second reason, he says, is for conscience' sake. Because it's right, I know in my spirit this is wrong, and in my conscience, I'm violating my conscience toward God if I resist authority. Then there's the last one, G. We have a moral obligation to support our government in order that they might provide services to us. He tells us this in verse 6 and 7. Because there's a government, and because we need a government, That government supplies services to us. And we have a moral obligation to support it in order because we receive its benefits. And then I've got an extra one down there, H. In addition, and this is my thoughts, this is not in the text, but I think it follows again. It seems to follow to me that as a Christian, I should genuinely desire to submit to and to support our government. Everybody followed me so far? All right? I'll tell you, I believe that. I think I can honestly say I do not want to not support my government. I don't care if it's the county government. I don't care if it's the state government. I don't care if it's the federal government. Now, when it comes time to figure my taxes, if my taxes say I owe $1,000, I don't send them $1,001. I send them $1,000. Now, that may not sound like I have such a great desire to support my government if I'm not giving them extra. I have yet to ever owe them $1,000 and say, here's another $2,000 to use wherever you see fit. I've never done that. I've never thought about doing that. Never crossed my mind to do that. And it probably never will. But on the other hand, if I do not, and there are times when I haven't had to pay taxes. There are times when our kids were small especially, and I may have paid in quarterly taxes. I was always self-employed. And let's suppose that I paid $1,000 in during the year. And it came time to do my taxes, and primarily because of earned income credit on your taxes, I got $3,000 back. I paid in $1,000. I got $3,000 back. You know what I call that? Welfare. That's welfare. What I do when I got the check? I spent it. I cashed it, and I paid bills with it. But there is something in me that tells me this is not the way it ought to be. This is not the way I want it to be. Now, if you hear nothing else I say today, hear that. So, these verses sound fairly absolute. They sound fairly rigid. They sound fairly no loopholes involved. So the question comes up, are there exceptions to submitting to the authority? Is there ever an instance where we can legitimately resist the government? Anybody think of one? Okay, if the government requires me to kill someone, and I would assume you meant unjustly.
Not in wartime.
Okay. Anybody else have one? Okay. Requires to do something contrary to what God requires of us. Okay, what John has given is a general thing, of which what Carol said is an example of that, an instance that falls under his statement. And I have heard people talk about this text for all my life. I've read all kinds of books and commentaries that talk about this verse, and when people bring this subject up, that is the exception that they will give without fail. I've never read anything or heard anybody say that that is not a legitimate exception. when God requires you, or the government requires, excuse me, to do what God forbids. Now, assuming that that is right, should that resistance be passive or aggressive? In other words, if the government requires Christians to do something that is wrong, should we resist that aggressively, like all band together and overthrow the government? Or should we resist it by just trying to fly under the radar and ignore it and let it pass? Okay? I'm not telling you what to do. I'm probably going to go the passive route to start with. Change the law?
Yes.
That would be a more proactive, but a little more passive than just really aggressive. Okay? All right, but here's the thing I was thinking about for a moment. If we grant that this is one legitimate exception, then we have to acknowledge that these verses are speaking to us not in absolute terms, but in general terms. And if we allow for one legitimate exception, if we acknowledge that these admonitions in these seven verses are general instructions, generally, then it is possible if there is one legitimate exception, there might be more. There may be other reasons and other legitimate ways and events where we can resist the government. Maybe not. But if we say there is one legitimate, there may be more. Some people claim that the form of government that we have gives us inherently the right to resist authority. They would say that countries that have a democratic government or a republic, like the United States has a built-in right for the citizens to resist their government. Whereas those living under a monarchy or a tyrant or a dictator do not. Now, I would agree that that is true to a degree. And that is this, that we have the right to resist given to us at the ballot. If I don't like a certain leadership's policies, I can resist by voting against them. Okay, I'm not saying it gives us the right to shoot them or to kill them or whatever, but I can legitimately resist it by voting them out. I suspect, you'll see this the last statement that we make here, that the origin of our country, how our country came to be, along with my natural inclinations to resist authority, and I have them. I don't know about you, but I have them. I suspect that those things, for the most part, have emboldened us to seek ways to resist that we can feel good about. It may be not for you, but I suspect for a lot of people that is the case. We don't like our government for some reason, so we are looking for an excuse. We are looking for a way to justify our resistance. So, let's look at a few objections to looking at this text in an absolute term. What about unjust and oppressive taxation? Suppose the government comes to me and they say, for every $100 that you make, you got to give us 35. I would say, thank you for the tax break, right? I may already be paying more than 35. What if they come to me and they say, for every $100 you make, we're going to take 80? I'd have a hard time feeding me and Susan and Granny on 20 bucks, or 20% of my income. What if they say, every $100 you make, we're going to take 90? Is there a point where they are starving me to death that gives me the right to physically resist? I think so. Now, where that point is, I don't know. It might be different for me than for you. But if the government takes my life one day at a time, I feel like I can resist that with good conscience. What if they have extreme policies that tear my home apart, tear my family apart, separate my family? Is there a point where I can resist that? I think so. What about the American Revolution? I remember the first time I was an adult, the first time that I ever entertained this thought of, was the American Revolution an unscriptural and immoral resistance of British rule? I don't know. I grew up thinking all these guys are godly my heroes, you know, and great people, and to suggest that they were wrong, that doesn't sit just real well. But were they? I don't know. A couple of things, and I don't know how things work. You know, we read things that are kind of just the surface statements of history, but one thing I was thinking about is, you know, for the King George in England to want the Americans to pay him some more taxes or whatever the case may be, or to have some kind of regulations that govern them, that touch their lives. For him to get that word to them took how much time? How long does it take to cross the Atlantic Ocean in those days? 2 or 3 months? I can't remember. I was wanting to think it's like 3 months or something. So for a policy to be made that touched their lives, it was a 3-month period before they knew about it. For them to say, hey, this is not going to work because of this, and to try to negotiate or try to appeal to him to change the ruling took another 3 months. So I can see where it would be a hard time to rule the American colonies from England just because of the time, because of the distance, and because of the lack of understanding how their life was. Now, maybe that came into play. I don't know. What about extreme oppression? What about atrocities, such as the Holocaust? What about atrocities such as the Japanese, as they in World War II went through China and other places and took captive what they called comfort women? Is that a legitimate reason to resist authority? I think so, obviously. What about my tax money being used to fund Planned Parenthood? Is that reason to resist? Is it reason to quit paying my taxes? What about my tax money going to buy friends, to give $50 million to some little country that it just goes in some leader's pocket, just so they'll be our friend? That's what we do. We buy friends with government money. What about the $150 billion, where it was cash supposedly that our government gave to Iran? Is that reason to resist my government? I'm not telling you answers. I've got a lot more questions than I've got answers. I'll tell you what I find myself. I find myself increasingly distrusting my government. When a few years ago a mayor, I think it was in Houston, put out a decree, a proclamation, or whatever, an order, a regulation, that pastors' sermons had to be scrutinized, I feel the radar of Big Brother getting perilously close to me. When I see a person who is self-employed as a baker, owns his own business, being forced to make cakes for someone he doesn't want to make a cake for because they're homosexual, and is being forced out of business and fined, and his life is, and business is ruined, I feel the radar of Big Brother coming perilously close to me. When we have a vacation rental, most of you know, down the road here. And when listing sites require me to agree with my signature that I will not discriminate on the basis of sexual identity, or they use the word transgenders, I feel the radar of Big Brother focusing on me. I find myself distrusting my government more and more, to the extent that I I want to hide. I want to disappear. I want to buy a 3-year supply of toilet paper and dry freeze food, and put a lock on my gate and come out at night. So how do I handle that? How should we behave in such a situation? How can I have the spirit toward my government, supporting my government, that I want to have, and yet find it a battle, butting heads with the things that really touch my life? I want us to look at a few verses and scriptures elsewhere. And this will be number 4 on your outline. Wise as serpents, harmless as doves. What does that mean? Wise as serpents, harmless as doves. You ever thought about that? I thought about that all growing up. You know, I hear that, somebody say that, and I read it, and I had trouble visualizing serpents as being wise. In fact, I had trouble visualizing anybody wanting to be anything resembling a serpent. That doesn't sound appealing to me. I could get the harmless as dove deal. And I could tell by the phrase they were meant to complement one another, but yet they were opposites. So, you tell me, what does being wise as serpents mean? Anybody got any ideas? Conniving like the serpent in the garden. Okay. Devious with a motive towards evil.
I don't think the motive is necessarily evil. I think they're emphasizing the wise part.
I guess a reverence
reference to their ability to hide. Okay. Kathy says, leave off the evil implications there.
In that
text, context. All right. I think we're getting close to the idea here. I think it talks about being shrewd, being cautious, being calculating, lying low unless there's a reason to be aggressive. Okay, to not go running off half-cocked. All right, to not get on Facebook and blabber everything, you know. Okay, you can always say something. It's hard to unsay stuff, right? Okay, I want to read in Matthew chapter 10. I'm not going to read this. I'm going to kind of paraphrase it as we go through. But Jesus picks his disciples. This is Matthew chapter 10, if you want to read it sometime. Gets his disciples, and he says, I'm sending you out. Care with you, don't care with you. You know, food or rain or change of clothes, don't load up with suitcases like you're moving. You're going to be on the move. But, he said, beware. Beware, because you need to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves, because I'm sending you forth like sheep in the midst of wolves. Okay, so the reason we need to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves is because we are sheep in the midst of wolves. Now, I talked a while ago about buying a bunch of stuff and hiding out, being a prepper, right? All right, this is not the context. If I was reading this, somebody tell me this is what your life's going to be like, you're going to be persecuted, they're going to come after you. It might be your kin folks. He goes on and talks about father against son, son against father. All right? You'll be persecuted for my sake because you're a Christian. I would think my inclination would be to hide. But one thing that stood out to me a couple of weeks ago, I was reading this. Jesus gives them these instructions as he tells them to go out and tell the gospel. Don't hide because of it. As you go, this is what you expect. But even in those circumstances, pay attention. Be wise as serpents, harmless as doves. The next point, number 5, I've got it called things black and things white. How many of you ever heard of the phrase a white lie? Okay? Here's an example of a white lie. A lady buys, or not buys, she gets a new hairstyle. Gets a new hairstyle, she goes home, she asks her husband, she says, does this hairstyle make my face look fat? He doesn't even have to look to tell the answer, does he? The answer is no. It doesn't make your face look fat. All right? Even if it does, that's right. That's a white lie, or could be a white lie. Okay, that's what we talk about when a white lie. Sometimes it's not just really bad. You know, you might feel a little bad about saying it, but it's not just evil, right? Self-preservation. Okay, I'm going to give you a definition of lying. I've got it written here because I want you to remember it. There's some key words in it. Lying is saying or implying something. You can be guilty of lying without talking. Saying or implying something that is not true in order to deceive, so that justice might be perverted, so that I can obtain something that is not justly mine, or not obtain something that I justly deserve. Everybody follow all that? Okay. With that said, let me give you a little trivia question. Is lying one of the Ten Commandments? Technically, no. The ninth commandment says, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Now that's a first cousin, the lying. But the commandment is, you don't tell something that destroys somebody else. If it's false. False witness against your neighbor. Now, you're not gaining anything or harming yourself necessarily, but the admonition is you are saying something against your neighbor that will hinder, harm him, that will destroy him, that will hurt him. Okay, now we're grasping at straws here, I understand. Okay, what about a white bribe? You ever heard of a white bribe? That's because I just made that up this past week. A white bribe. Here's a white bribe. When my boys were little or my grandkids are small, and they're at the house, and I might lay down on the floor and say, don't you scratch my back. I'll give you a quarter if you scratch my back. Or I'll do this or I'll do that if you scratch my back. Sooner or later, one of the adults in the room is going to say this. Papa is having to bribe his grandkids. That's a white bribe. There's no harm to it, okay? But I'm coaxing them into doing something for my benefit. Now, I've got a definition for a bribe. Anything such as money, property, or a favor offered or given to someone in a position of trust to induce him to act dishonestly. Now, everybody understand that definition? The necessary ingredient for lying, a lie, or a bribe to be sinful. The necessary ingredient is this, the perversion of justice. Okay, if the attempt is in order to pervert justice, it's ungodly and it's a sin. In a bribe, there are two sides. There's the person who is giving a bribe, and there's the person who is receiving the bribe. Okay? Now I want to give you some scripture here, but I want to make this disclaimer. You can read this on here too. I'm going to use the word bribe to refer to things that are we might call white bribes. And in fact, you might not call them a bribe at all. But I'm going to use the word bribe. I could use other words, and some of you are going to take exception to things I'm calling bribes. But just be quiet, okay? Don't tell me now. Tell me after church, all right? Just humor me for a few minutes, okay? And the reason I'm using the word bribe is because you're going to remember this. You're going to remember this 5 years from now. When you talk about the word bribe, you're going to remember these instances. You may not agree with me, but you're going to remember it. So let's look at some verses. You see one down there. Here's the verse. I don't have the reference yet. But it says this, a gift is as a precious stone in the eyes of him who has it. Wherever it turns, it prospers. Is that a good statement or a bad statement? Y'all afraid to answer. Okay? If you're the one that has the gift, does the statement indicate that you feel good about it? Yes. Look at it. A gift is as a precious stone in the eyes of him who has it. Wherever it turns, it prospers. If I'm the person who has the gift, I feel lucky. I feel fortunate. I feel blessed that I have this gift that I can use to bring me prosperity. Okay? Anything wrong with that? No. Nothing wrong at all. Most translations, this is Proverbs 17:8, if you want to write the reference down there. Most translations doesn't use the word gift, uses the word bribe. If I had used that word, a bribe is as a precious stone in the eyes of him who has it. Wherever it turns, it prospers him. Would you have had the tendency to look at that statement in a little more negative light? Yes, because of the way we view that word. Bribe. You can look it up in the Hebrew, the word means bribe. Okay? The word itself has no negative connotations. All right, next verse. A wicked man receives a bribe from the bosom to pervert the ways of justice. Is that verse a positive or negative sensing verse? Negative. Obviously negative. What makes it negative? Pervert the ways of justice. Here's that idea that we're trying to pervert justice. Okay? The description of the man, the wicked man, also gives us a negative connotation. So these things, particularly these things, the idea that someone is wicked and the evidence of their wickedness is they're trying to pervert justice leads us to conclude that the means they are using is a bribe and it's ungodly. It is wrong. That comes from Proverbs 17:23. Both of those verses are in the same chapter, one a positive use, one a negative use. The next one. A gift in secret subdues anger, and a bribe in the bosom, strong wrath. Two phrases, they both mean the same thing. This is the way Proverbs a lot of times are written. Two phrases saying the same thing, just different ways. First one is this, a gift in secret subdues anger, and a bribe in the bosom, and the bribe in the bosom means it's like this. I'm holding it here. Why am I holding it here? Because I don't want you to see it. Same thing as a gift in secret. A bribe in the bosom. Okay, is this verse positive or negative? If you have someone angry at you, would you want this gift? Would you want some means to subdue their anger? Yes, I would. This is a positive sounding verse. Now I look at it and I say, boy, something wrong here. Why do I say that? Because of that word secret. Most things that I did in secret, I was up to no good. Right? But if I'm in this situation, a gift in secret subdues anger. If somebody's angry at me, I need something to subdue their anger, don't I? I need some way to appease them. That's what this verse is saying. A gift in secret. I lost my place. Subdues anger. And a bribe in the bosom, strong wrath. Okay, Exodus 20, chapter 23 gives verses talking about prohibiting bribes. I'm not going to read that verse to you. Then let's do one in Luke 18. Luke 18, 1 to 5. This tells us, Jesus tells a parable, and he's not telling the parable to talk about the subject. He's giving the parable to talk about persistence. But here's the story that he gave. It says there was a king, or a judge rather, a judge who did not fear God nor any man. So here's the judge. Doesn't fear God, doesn't fear man. And this woman, this widow woman, comes to him trying to ask him to appease her or to deliver her from her avenger. Somebody is after her. Doesn't tell us why they're after her, but they're just after her. Perhaps they're suing her, carrying her to court, whatever the case may be. And this judge apparently has the authority to give her some relief. And that's what she's asking. He ignores her. She keeps coming back, keeps coming back. Finally, the judge says, gosh, this is a paraphrase. Gosh, I'm tired of this woman bugging me. Give her what she wants. The woman has bribed the judge. How is that a bribe? What is she offering him for in return getting what she wants?
Peace.
That's it. I'll leave you alone. I'll leave you alone if you give me what I want. She's offering him something in exchange for deliverance from her enemy, and it's peace. Now, is that a bribe? Let me ask you this question. Is that an ungodly bribe? If the woman's cause is righteous, if she is being sued unjustly, accused unjustly, and she goes to this wicked judge who fears not God nor man, her cause is righteous, and he gives her some relief, wicked judge, is that a wicked, sinful bribe?
No.
No, because there's no perversion of justice. Doesn't matter if he's wicked or not. If her cause was unrighteous, and he was a good judge, flip the things around, her cause was unrighteous, is that a sinful bribe? Yes. The difference is the issue of perverting justice. Okay, now, back to the serpents and the doves. How do you gain favor from an oppressive government? From a government that is being increasingly hostile. I'm going to give you some ideas. One, work to earn the trust of those in authority. Work to earn the trust of those in authority. Let me tell you how that does not look. If you get stopped, you've been speeding, and you get stopped, and you get a speeding ticket, and you get mad at the cop because he won't just give you a warning, you're not doing yourself any favors. All right? If you ever come face to face with that cop again, and he has the opportunity to give you a little leeway, but he remembers that time you give him a good cussing because he gave you a ticket, chances are it's not going to go well. Work to earn the trust of those in authority. I'm going to read four verses in Daniel chapter 6. It pleased Darius. Darius is top dog. Darius is the king. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. And over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king should have no damage. So he's laying out his chain of command. Daniel is one of the second in command of the three people under the king. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presence and the princes. He liked Daniel the best because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king thought to set him over the whole realm. Then the presidents and the princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom. But they could find no occasion nor fault. For as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. Do you want to have favor with your authorities? Then be a godly person. Obviously, all of us sin. But the people who are closest to us and the people who are in authority, if you have people that you know and you know them personally that are in authority, make sure your life is a reflection of righteousness. So that if they try to find fault with you, they can't. Daniel chapter 5. Now let me back up one statement here. The statement is this: don't hide or water down the truth. Your enemies expect the truth from you. I think this is an important point. People who are enemies of God know the difference between right and wrong. And when they see you and me compromising the truth just for a little benefit to ourselves, they lose their respect for you. They may not like it. They may not like what you do. May not like what you say. But they respect the truth and they expect the truth from you. Daniel chapter 5, the previous chapter to this, Daniel is there again. Belshazzar is the king. Belshazzar is having a wild party. It is evil, immoral, a lot of stuff going on. And in the midst of it, he decides to profane and blaspheme the God of Israel that he has conquered and took all their riches, and he gets the golden vessels that used to be in the temple of the Israelites and brings them and puts his junk in it that would blaspheme the Israelites. And suddenly, there's a portrait or the figure of a hand is seen on the wall with a finger writing on the wall, just like you might write in the dirt. And Belshazzar, everyone there sees it. Belshazzar sees it, and he is horrified. Now, I don't know what that hand looked like. It really doesn't matter. I think it's big enough that everybody saw it. I don't think it was like a dry erase marker, you know, that you could wipe off. I think it was engraved in that stone, if it was stone. Somehow it was unmistakably there. You could go up later and feel the effects of it. And he is terrified. His knees are shaking. It's almost as if his hips are out of joint. He's terrified. He calls his wise men. They have no clue what it says. It's some lettering there. They can't tell him what it says. And so they call Daniel. Somebody remembers Daniel, and they bring Daniel. Now I want you to listen to what Daniel says. He said, and the guy has promised him all these gifts. We'll clothe you in purple, make you one of the head honchos in the kingdom, give you riches, if you can tell me what this means. He says, Belshazzar, keep your stuff. I don't want it, but I'll tell you what it means. God gave your father a great kingdom, Nebuchadnezzar. God gave your father a great kingdom. Riches, land, blessed him with conquering everything, and yet it went to his head. And he ended up crazy, his senses taken from him, living out in the field and being and eating grass like an ox until his senses returned and he humbled himself before God. He said, Belshazzar, you didn't learn much from that. You knew that. You knew the story. You knew it happened. He's your father. And yet it meant nothing to you. It taught you nothing. And here you are, blaspheming God, and God has wrote this on the wall. Meni, meni, tekel, upharsin. Meni. Now to me, even stop right there. The nerve of Daniel to tell him that. Reminds me of Proverbs 16. When a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Many, your kingdom has reached its boundaries. Your kingdom has come to an end. Tekel, you're weighed in the balances and found wanting, found deficient. You farce and your kingdom will be taken from you. Again, how his life was spared? By the grace of God. Instead of Belshazzar being angry and killing him, Belshazzar puts a purple robe on him. But Belshazzar never sees the morning sun. Belshazzar is killed that night. Wise as a serpent, harmless as a dove. Don't be arrogant. Don't be snotty. Don't be obnoxious. Don't flaunt your God before the world. Being wise as a serpent. This week I got an issue of To Every Tribe. I don't know if you're familiar with anybody gets this or not, a little letter thing. To Every Tribe, missionaries. In that, this article, or they have an article in here, this, the title of the article is Protecting Your Missionaries in a Digital Age. And it gives an example of how that some missionary in a country that is hostile to Christianity came home, gave a presentation in their home church or, you know, his own deputation at different churches, and somebody innocently put something on social media somewhere about this. And enough so that the whole team's ministry was ruined. They had to shut down and move out. All right, being wise as serpents. You know, I thought this morning, I've never had this thought before. I've been preaching here for 20 years. But our sermons are on the internet. And there are things that either me or John could say that we ought not to be saying. That are, that, and not because it may necessarily harm us personally, but because it may put in danger some people somewhere that we know. A year or two ago, I looked up a guy on Facebook that I've known for, well, I know him in college. Became a Christian in college. And he is in a location that I doubt if the government knows his primary purpose for being there. When I looked him up on Facebook, I had this thought, be careful what you say to him, just to tell him hi. Be careful what you say to him. So I was. He replied to me like 2 or 3 days later in a very short, general, friendly way. But again, no revealing of what he was up to, where he was at, what was going on. Nothing. Okay? I haven't heard from him since. I haven't tried to contact him since. I haven't heard from him since. Okay? And the reason is, part of the reason, because I'm afraid I'm going to blow it. You know, I'm afraid I'm going to say something that somebody can track him down. Okay, that is very common, more so in our day than before. Build friendships. Now, you know, what if I don't want to? What if I'm an introvert and I don't like doing that kind of stuff? Okay? Suppose that I worked for Stephen Beavers. He's got the glass doctor. Suppose he hires me to run his, to be in the office. And he goes out on jobs, does. So I'm at the office, and people come in. I deal with the customers that come in. And I'm there, and I'm there 2 or 3 weeks, and one day he says, hey, can you hang around at work? I need to talk to you about something. I said, okay. So after work, I hang around, and he says, you know, I've had 2 or 3 people tell me that you weren't very friendly. You're not very friendly to the customers. What if I say to Stephen, I want to be sincere, you know? I don't want to talk to people, so I don't talk to people. Okay? You know what Stephen's going to tell me? He's going to say, I understand. Maybe you need to work on being friendly. But in the meantime, you be friendly, whether you feel like it or not. All right? I'm not an outgoing person, but I see value. I see value. Whether it's sincere or to my benefit or not, I see value in knowing my officials, in knowing, have a personal friendship with people in authority. The day may come when that reaps benefits. You ever seen the movie Fiddler on the Roof? What's the guy's name, Tevye? He is, if I'm not saying this right, just again, overlook me because I never could know how to say his name. But he's in a Jewish community, a Jewish culture in Russia, around 1900 plus or minus, and they're there. The Russian people are starting to have a resistance to the Tsar or whatever. Maybe that's already over. I don't know. But they also have this resistance to Jewish culture. Okay? He's there. He's a milkman. You know how he is if you've seen the movie. And a lot of nights he goes to the tavern, and he comes home. On his way home, he's walking everywhere. All he has is a milk cow, maybe a horse. I don't know. Remember. He's walking home, and he's about half lit most of the time, right? There's another guy in the movie, the constable. You remember the constable? And sometimes there's just this 15-second interaction, 2 or 3 different times, where Tevye is going home, and he's staggering around. He may be singing or, you know, whatever. And he's on his way home, and he looks over, and he sees this constable standing on the corner. And the constable is just standing. And they make eye contact. Tevye tries to get control of himself, you know, and tries to straighten up, walk a little more dignified. And the contact between these two men, one is the constable. The other guy is just a person in the community, Tevye. It leaves me with the impression, I don't know if it did you or not, but I got the feeling, after 2 or 3 little interactions between these two men, I got the feeling that under other circumstances, if it wasn't this great chasm between them of being a Jew and being a Russian, that they might have been good buddies, that they might have been friends. But that keeps them from being very close. But one day, Tevye is on his way home, I think, and the constable comes up to him, puts his arm around him, And this is, I don't know if the, for sure the words, this is my interpretation of it. He says, Tevye, I just want to let you know. I want to warn you. There's going to be a demonstration. And Tevye has to repeat it a time or two, and Tevye is kind of sobering up to think, what is he talking about? And he realizes what he means. That's what I'm talking about. Being wise as serpents. As we live in a culture where it is becoming increasingly unpopular to be a Christian. Where it is becoming increasingly unpopular to have moral values. I feel like the resistance to us and the persecution to us is not going to come necessarily from Washington, D.C. The implications of it might, but the enforcements might be more on a local level. And not just that, but the antagonism against Christianity from other citizens will be blinked at and overlooked by the officials. And it's prudent for you and for me. Be what Jesus says. Go forth. Tell the gospel. I've got a statement where he says, don't unnecessarily hide the fact that you're a Christian. There may be instances like these missionaries, where you limit how you do it. When John and them go to the country they go to, I've learned something this morning. They don't get off the airplane saying, hey, we're Christians here to save you. They probably get sent home. Right? Don't unnecessarily hide the fact that you're Christian, but don't be obnoxious about it either. Don't be stupid. Be wise. Sleep with one eye open. Pay attention. I can tell you an example. I have seen this with my own eyes. I have seen local officials break policy. I bet I could name a dozen ways in this one instance where local officials broke policy that they could be fired for in order to ease the life of someone they felt like was falsely accused. I've seen that. Because they knew the person. As we go through our lives, pay your taxes. Give taxes to whom taxes are due. Give custom to whom custom is due. Give respect to whom respect is due. Give honor to whom honor is due. And if the time comes, I didn't say when, I said if, where you are convinced you must resist the government, get off Facebook. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your word. God, I do not want to be guilty of giving us, emboldening us, encouraging us to resist the government. I do not want to do that. I want to support my government. God, just help us to be wise. Help us to be smart. Help us to be honest. Help us to be true. Help us to share the gospel. In Jesus' name I pray, amen.